And welcome to WPFW, and this is the Hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, and it's nice to be with you at the end of this year. My thanks to all those who choose to support us yesterday on Giving Tuesday. It's really appreciated that you support this Jazz and Justice radio station, as you have for over 48 years. For those of you who are new to We the People, it is a news magazine that comes on every Wednesday, and we deal with the issues of race, politics, history, and culture, particularly where they intersect, but more importantly, where people have done hard work in those areas. In the past, they've left us a legacy. In the present, they work along with us to make a better community, building better communities, and they give us a guidance for the future. This morning, we have an interesting question. The U.S. Constitution, is it anti-democratic? Does it fuel authoritarianism? To answer those questions, our guest is Clarence Lussain. Dr. Lussain is professor of political science and the director of international affairs program at Howard University. For more than 40 years and in more than 75 countries, he has written about, studied, and has been active in national and international human rights, anti-racism politics, diaspora engagements, both social and political, U.S. foreign policy, democracy building, and various other social justice issues. Dr. Lussain is an international expert and observer with the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance, and among his many books are The Black History of the White House and his latest $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman versus Andrew Jackson and the Future of American Democracy. Dr. Lussain, welcome. As always, I welcome you.
Thank you, and thank you to the PFW audience.
Let's get right into it. Certainly some of your students are studying your discipline, and they have ambitions for a political career and involvement for public service. I like to say, knowing your work as I do, that they hope to be good and active citizens as well as leaders. How do you introduce the reintroduce the Constitution to them? And is this the same context that you want us to have in mind for this discussion?
So thank you for that question. As political scientists, of course, we discuss the Constitution with our students. But I would definitely say at Howard and for most progressive political scientists, the Constitution is seen as a living document. And that's critical because there is a central debate over whether the Constitution should be seen as some would use the term originalist, and be interpreted by what the writers saw as what they meant when they wrote it, or if it should be seen as dynamic, meaning that it should absolutely be adjusted as the times have changed and as history changes. And that's really critical in this moment, and I'm glad we're having this discussion. Because as we think forward and past the Trump era, which will come to an end, there's an argument of, well, let's go back to the old days. And in fact, part of the reason we're in this era is because of some of the flaws that are in the Constitution. So to me, it puts it very high on the agenda for progressives to really begin to think through, how do we get past the moment we're at and we actually create a new, more fair, inclusive era? So let me make two statements that are true, but are in conflict with each other. One is that the country cannot go forward unless there really is constitutional reform and amendments that are more inclusive of labor rights, for example, or rights around the environment, or better protection for voting rights. The second statement is that at the moment, it's almost impossible to amend the Constitution. So those are two realities that we're going to need to be grappling with right now, because we really are in a bind with the undemocratic elements that we see are being exploited every single moment by the current administration. For example, pardon power that's in the Constitution, that's unchecked, unaccountable. And even just this morning, we saw Trump pardon a former Democratic representative who was accused of bribery and some other crimes. But that power is unchecked. And the only way to get rid of it is with a constitutional amendment. And there are other issues as well. The reason we have Trump in the first place is because of the Electoral College, which is an undemocratic election system that no one else in the world uses, nowhere. There were a couple of efforts in France, even in a couple other places, for a very brief period. Then they realized how undemocratic it was and basically kind of threw it out. But we're the only country in the world that has any kind of system like that.
Well, let's focus on that for a second. I'm going to combine some of your remarks here. It seems, at least pushing this listener, that we need to understand who the framers were. You know, there's a lot of romanticism about the origins of our country and its ideals and what it was immediately striving to do. And I put the inflection on immediately because people question whether that's the case. So instead of artisans, tradesmen, laborers, servants, and enslaved people, and small farmers being represented, you had basically an elite that was trying to exercise the best of their own conditions, putting it politely, the best of Enlightenment thinking. George Washington himself, if his estate was valued in today's money, it would be about over $400 million. And he owned land not only that we think of in Virginia, but in New York, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and all the Ohio Valley. And he was an important shareholder in the Bank of Columbia and the Bank of Alexandria. So I just give those scattered references to make him an example of the many elite interests that went into the formulation of the document. If that is the case, we're really dealing with the formulation of a republic as opposed to a democracy. And you've made that clear. So what elements, you've already begun to point some of them out, what elements of the Constitution particularly lend themselves to being anti-democratic?
So a couple of things, as you point out. So one is when they wrote We the People, it really was we the property white males are going to set the stage for how this country goes forward. And that excluded the majority of the country. It excluded women. It excluded people who were enslaved. It excluded free Black people. It excluded indigenous populations. It excluded immigrants. So just kind of a wide sweep of the people who were really kind of making up the composed the country had no voice, had no say in this document that would govern and still governs. Now, the original Constitutional Convention in 1787 was to address the problems of the Articles of Confederation. One of the main problems of the Articles of Confederation was that it was virtually unamendable. There was a provision that allowed for it to be changed, but it required 100% unanimous agreement from all 13 states, which never happened. So there were proposal after proposal to try to change it. So they called the Constitutional Convention and then realized we need to throw that out altogether and we need to start basically from scratch. And critical to the new Constitution that was drafted in 1787, sent out to be ratified in 1787 and 1788, and was finally ratified in 1789. Critical to that is Article 5. So Article 1 focuses on the House of Representatives, Article 2 on the presidency, Article 3 on the Supreme Court. But it's really Article 5 that lays the ground for being able to amend the Constitution. Because even then, it was recognized that in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 100 years, the country would change and the Constitution needed to be flexible enough to make an adjustment to that. And this is really a counter argument to the originalists. Because when you think of people like James Madison, for example, who was central to writing the Constitution, he was one of the clearest voices that it had to be amended at some point, that we don't have all of these answers. We cannot see the future. Even Thomas Jefferson, some of the other reluctant ones. And so the originalists are really kind of creating a mythical history when they say we should go back to see what they were writing about. And even the Federalist Papers in 1789, when the Constitution was out to be ratified by the 13 states, there were a series of articles that were published, I think about 85 or so, that eventually became known as the Federalist Papers. And if you're in take political science class or you're in law school, you read the Federalist Papers. This is Hamilton and Madison. And even they argued that, and this was really kind of, you know, propaganda for passing the Constitution, but even they argue we have to have a process by which it can be amended. It should be one in which it can't be so easily amended. It could be changed every week and then it would have no power, but that it shouldn't be impossible. But in fact, the way that it ended up becoming amendable has virtually become impossible. The principal way that the Constitution is amended begins in Congress. There's a constitutional proposal from some member. For example, Coca-Cola should be the official soft drink of the U.S. and they want a constitutional amendment. I use this example actually all the time. There's a debate and there are those who oppose Coca-Cola, think it's the worst drink in the world, it's unhealthy, it's a corporatist view. There are those who think that it's the greatest drink in the world. There's a debate and there's a vote. You need two-thirds of the House of Representatives, two-thirds of the U.S. Senate to pass. If it gets over that hurdle, then it goes to the states, and then there are 100 legislative bodies that have to approve it because each state, or at least get to look at it, because in each state, the state House and the state Senate both have to pass in order for that state to be considered having come to an agreement. So you need three quarters of the states. You need 36 states to agree on this proposal coming from Congress. So that hurdle is virtually impossible these days because it requires massive bipartisan agreement. And so we're in a situation where effectively the last amendment that passed that really had significance was the 26th Amendment in 1971, and that was to lower the voting age to 18. And that occurred in the context of the Vietnam War, where you had young people who were 18, 19, 20, who were going to war, who were being injured, who were being killed, but could not vote. And so it became critical and fair that the voting age was lowered. And that points to something else about the history of the amendments. Once you get past the first 10 amendments, which were passed in 1791,
the Bill of Rights,
clusters, mm-hmm. you get clusters of amendments that actually come out of periods of war. So the Civil War, for example, you get the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. Coming out of World War I, you get the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. You get the what's the other name came out of that? You get Prohibition, which yes. is kind of being overthrown. So, you know, you have periods, but they're long periods, decades where there are no amendments passed at all.
We'll continue that point that you're making, Dr. Lusain. I just want to remind listeners that here on WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org, and other social media platforms, you're listening to this hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. But importantly, our topic at hand is the U.S. Constitution, anti-democratic, with a question mark behind that. To further explore that, we have Dr. Clarence Lusain, the professor of political science and the director of the International Affairs Program at Howard University, and the author of many, many books, including $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman versus Andrew Jackson, and The Future of American Democracy. Your last wonderful compact flurry of explanation of governance, Dr. Lusain, begs a few questions. When you talk about the hurdles of getting through the legislative branch of the federal government, then subsequently the state legislative branch, the insinuation historically or romantically has been that once it goes through those processes, that the decisions, the discernment, that representative officials make represents the voice of the people. And I wanted to get back to that point. Particularly, let's explain the Electoral College once again and why it really does deny the voice of the people in many regards.
So at the Constitutional Convention, one of the major debates was around the executive branch. And should there even be a president? Or should there be co-presidents, right? So all of that was kind of debated. And there was a, to put a, the best light on it, a fear that an individual could be elected who would be elected not out of their being qualified, but that they're capturing a popular sentiment. And so the elite men who were writing the Constitution wanted to have a backstop. And so they drew on this practice, which had existed in history and a few other places, of this Electoral College, where once there was the popular vote, then each state would also have a second vote of people who were known as electors. And the electors are individuals who are not elected by you or me, they're selected by parties or by candidates. And they come to vote, and they are not obligated, at least originally, not obligated to follow the popular vote. And historically, what that has meant is that in every single election, there have been what they call rogue electors. Individuals somewhere who vote distinct from how that state actually had voted. Now, the electors...
Let us not refrain from saying that this has been an issue in the last few elections. I want to explicitly say that.
It happened with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. It happened with George W. Bush and Al Gore. So, it's, you know, it's, and there's some other instances in history. And each state gets a specific number of electoral votes that's basically determined by the number of members they have in Congress. So California has 52 representatives and two senators, so it gets 54 electoral votes and so forth. And when you add them all up, it's 538. Now, it's 538 because of the 23rd Amendment, which gave Washington, D.C. three electoral votes. Before that, it was 535. So they meet in December after the November election, and then they vote. And again, they do not necessarily have to follow the popular vote. Now, some states have passed laws where it's punishable, or at least electors are removed if they don't, but most states have not. And so you can still have a situation where a state votes in the popular vote for the Democrat, but you get to the electoral vote and there's a decision that, they will not give it to that person. So that creates, clearly an undemocratic problem of democracy. Donald Trump lost by 3 million votes to here 3.5 million to Hillary Clinton in 2016, but he had the right combination of states that gave him the Electoral College. The other thing about the Electoral College, it also reflects another undemocratic dimension of the Constitution, which is the very structure of the Senate. The Senate, each state gets two senators. There was a compromise at the Constitutional Convention over how representation would happen in Congress, whether it should be proportional, each state would get the same number of members, or whether it should be larger the population, the larger the whatever. And it was a compromise that the House of Representatives would be based on population and the Senate would be equal. The problem is that then you have a very unfair distribution because you say a state like California with tens and tens of millions of people is equal to South Dakota. All right, so or Vermont, these small states with populations, size of DC, for example. And so, but they have a disproportionate vote in the US Senate, not only relative to their inclusion in the Electoral College count, but when you look at the role of the Senate, for example, in approving Supreme Court nominations. Or you look at the role of the Senate in determining appointments and ratifying treaties. The Senate also determines and votes on people who are cabinet members. So that particular body, the US Senate itself, is an undemocratic structure, which again has a major role in elections.
And even if you held to those ideals, it seems to be a recent practice by, I think, objective observation that they're not advising but consenting without too much deliberation, at least on the part of one party. I'm trying to objectify that, if you will.
Right.
So we mentioned amendments and, of course, the Bill of Rights, the first 10. With thanks to James Madison and George Mason, since we're emanating from the Washington, D.C. region, modeled certain things. Many say, particularly the Virginia Declaration of Rights at the time. But
Right.
the thing there is, does that even represent the interests of the framers for the everyday person?
The amendment process?
No, I meant referring to the Bill of Rights themselves. It seems to be the one place that people would leverage an argument against that, or for rather, that the Constitution does try to seek to have us be a democracy.
So we should remember that the Bill of Rights was not in the original Constitution. The Bill of Rights was excluded because there had specific rights were excluded because there had been an argument at the Constitution or the Constitutional Convention that if certain rights are included, that could imply that rights that are not included are not constitutionally protected. So there were a number of people, including people like Madison, for example, who pushed back against having this Bill of Rights. However, there was vast popular support for it because people had lived under King George, and they did not have free speech. They did not have the right to assemble. They did not have right to petition. They did not have a right to a jury trial. There were a number of elements that affected people daily Even though they didn't have a particular role in writing the Constitution, they felt that. And they would have a role in its ratification. So as a compromise, the plan was basically, let's pass this original draft. And then when we send it out for ratification to the states, we will make it clear that as soon as possible, we will include this other bill, these other rights. And so 2 years later, 1791, is when the first 10 amendments came about. And again, there was a popular sense that these rights had to be enshrined. Now, that argument that rights that were not included would not be seen as constitutionally protected wasn't necessarily wrong. And to this very day, there are rights that are protected in law. For example, labor rights, but they're not in the Constitution. And modern constitutions are hundreds of pages because they do include labor rights, human rights, women's rights, environmental rights, children's rights. You know, these are all enumerated in ways that are captured in U.S. law, but laws that could be overturned, laws that the U.S. Supreme Court can reinterpret and remove.
And I'm for interjection for a second, just for a moment. So the explicitness in other constitutions of other nations, are there any things particularly problematic, or I'll use the contrapositive, are there things that are particularly helpful or worthy of notice?
Oh, absolutely. So there are, you know, many scholars who do what's known as constitutional comparative studies. And so they look at, you know, different constitutions and, you know, how they're driven, how they're written. Particularly, they look at how they are amended. And almost universally, the U.S. is ranked at the very bottom of amendability in terms of the Constitution. And that's a real problem, because it means the U.S. cannot move forward on a whole range of issues that other governments are able to do with, you know, with some degree of democratic flexibility. There are studies that kind of look at that process.
All right. Listeners, you're listening to We the People right here on WPFW 89.3 FM, your Pacifica radio station, 50,000 watts strong. But 48 years of support from listeners dedicated to jazz and justice and building a better community, one broadcast at a time. All that and more with public affairs, news, jazz, and justice. We're going to take a break right now and do service to you by presenting some PSAs. And we want you to continue to join us on this conversation regarding the Constitution, anti-democratic. Our guest is political scientist Clarence Lussain. Stay with us and we'll be right back. Thank you.
The WPFW Local Station Board is hosting a community town hall on Saturday, December 13th from 12 noon until 3 p.m. Our theme is Free Airwaves, Fighting for Community and Public Radio. With the economic upheaval caused by DOGE, the social stress exacerbated by the military occupation of the Capitol, and the harm inflicted on innocent people by ICE agents, it is more important than ever to have an independent grassroots media focused on building communities, amplifying marginalized voices, and driving social movements. The town hall takes place on Saturday, December 13th from 12 noon until 3 p.m. at the Brookland Busboys and Poets, 625 Monroe Street, Northeast in the district. Additional information can be found online at wpfwfm.org. WPFW, building community one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, with our guest, political scientist Clarence Lussain. Dr. Lussain is the professor of political science and the director of the International Affairs Program at Howard University. He has done work in his discipline for more than 40 years in more than 75 countries. And again, we're talking about the U.S. Constitution and anti-democratic. So, no, we've got an echo, but I think it's cleared up. Okay, thank you. I also wanted to add that you heard about our meeting concerning the affairs of the station, but a new way to tie into the station is our WPFW app available on Apple and on Google Play. It's a very direct way to listen to your program anywhere you go, and there are over 100 programmers that provide you music and public affairs and news. Dr. Lusain, thank you for being with us. Let's continue our conversation. We might as well bring it into our contemporary situation. For decades, we've heard now of politicians and officials running or adjudicating or governing on the basis of the Constitution. Not only do they take an oath going into office, but they often use this as a talking point. And yet we have a wide variety of people, sometimes constitutional lawyers who become presidents, sometimes presidents who don't seem to have a good grasp or care about the Constitution at all. How does a layperson at least begin to take an understanding or take up the importance of the Constitution in her, his, or their everyday life?
So that's a great question. And I've given it some thought and kind of looked at again, comparatively, what are other countries doing around just that particular question? And interestingly, AI has actually offered some opportunities. There are a number of countries like Japan, for example, or I think I was reading in England, where there are very interactive AI driven websites where you can ask questions about the Constitution and you can track ways in which the Constitution and laws are, for example, tied to campaign donations or ways in which across political spectrums, particular issues are argued and debated. And so you can do that here if you're interested. There, you can take the time to sit down, but we need more opportunities for making it easy for people to be able to go on and ask and get answers to questions about the Constitution and how it operates and how it functions and the different branches. So, for example, specifically looking at, say, the Supreme Court and looking at not only cases affecting the Supreme Court, but looking at issues like conflict of interest, looking at issues of, inconsistencies. The Supreme Court in particular to me stands out because of its kind of undemocratic nature from how you actually even get on the court. So, for example, there's nothing in the Constitution that mandates when someone's nominated what the process should be and what should be the timing on that process. So this is why Mitch McConnell can hold up a nomination for almost a year and then ram through one in a couple of months or less, because there are norms and practices, but they're not laws and they're certainly not in the Constitution. And so, there are ways to that should be adjustments to that. And the Supreme Court, as it has evolved over times, has often been the means by which it's abridged the Constitution. So, for example, Plessy v. Ferguson. So this was a case in 1896 in over racial segregation. And Homer Plessy was an individual in Louisiana who, with his colleagues planning, deliberately violated segregation on a train in order to create a case that would go to the Supreme Court. The hope was that as these laws were spreading rapidly around the South, that the Supreme Court would actually look at the 14th Amendment, which had a very clear statement on equality under the law. What the Supreme Court did was not overthrow the 14th Amendment, but to reinterpret it in the interest of segregation and white supremacy. So it came up with this facile argument that you could have equality even with separation, the separate but equal kind of doctrine. And that lasted up until the Brown decision in 1954. So the Supreme Court is not necessarily an arbitrator or fair arbitrator always of the Constitution. And we saw with Roe v. Wade, where it actually took away a right that had been enshrined, again, not in the Constitution, which would have technically required a constitutional amendment, but an interpretation of the law from a more conservative vantage point. So there, you know, there's a real need for much clearer guidelines and for reforming the court on everything from its ethical guidelines, mandatory ethical guidelines that are needed, as well as term limits, because sitting on the court for like 30 years, like Clarence Thomas, has just been just an unmitigated disaster.
Yes, you're citing the lifetime appointments that are by design for Supreme Court justices, of course. You know, I was thinking about what you were just saying, and on one hand, one could be discouraged and think that it's untenable in one's lifetime to achieve some changes. But on the other hand, regardless of how power is instituted or seated in these different branches of government, change does happen, and it does happen from the people. Do you, your students, and other people you work with, it sounds a little amorphous, but how do you have any hope for these eventual changes? And is there something that can be done differently?
So I think part of it is it begins with people being aware of these issues. So when I, and probably when you, when we were coming up in elementary and junior high, middle school, high school, we had to take civics courses. It was just a regular thing. It was not anything special at all. Everyone had to take a civics course. So that just kind of fundamentally dialed you into, you lived in a government. There's a local government, there's a state government, there's a federal government, there are elections, there's laws. And, you know, you have to be aware of what those processes are. That does not exist anymore. We get students at the university level who have no idea of three branches of government, how they interact with each other, you know, what the Constitution are. And so, you know, we spend a lot of time. And, you know, if you come through my class, by the end of it, you should pretty much know all of, well, at least most of the 27 amendments to the Constitution. There's only 27, right? So you should be able to kind of name those 27. And, you know, and then just how, you know, how the Constitution works or doesn't work. So part of it is informing people, but we need to do more of that way, way, way outside of university. It should be happening in community centers. It should be happening in churches on a regular basis, so that people really are aware of, and then when you see these violations, you know, that's the basis for people understanding how to deal with them. So for example, Trump's completely illegal attacks on these boats in the Caribbean. They have been illegal from the very beginning. You know, a lot of attention has been focused on, you know, this second strike of, you know, two people who survived the first strike. But the first strike was a war crime. The second strike was just a second war crime. But it wasn't any necessarily worse because these are violations of international law, Geneva Convention, and U.S. law. But the fact that people are even confused in debating and using terms like allegedly and maybe, you know, shows a real disconnect in terms of, you know, what people should really, really understand.
And there's something to be said about context. I'll give you an example of how there's twisted argument. Well, a war hasn't been declared, but yet the verbiage is we're waging a war against narco-terrorists and drug smuggling, but yet a war hasn't been declared. So from one side, they say, therefore, there is no crime. Well, there's a crime when there's other established law, which has not been found to be against the Constitution within our own system, or the codes of military justice or international law. And so you can't have it both ways, simply. And this is the problem again. You're getting back to the main crux of things. Rhetorically, someone can run and campaign on, I will defend the Constitution. They can even take an oath, but political power and will can defy that. I'm surprised you haven't mentioned emoluments. Also, clearly the Constitution was explicitly against that. So if you're an originalist, you have to take that issue seriously. Yet presently, this has been probably the second administration that's gravely violated those considerations.
Oh, absolutely. Now, so the originalists are also kind of aware of these conflicts too. So a few years ago, probably around the time of Newt Gingrich, I think, there was a big effort on the part of the Republicans to read the Constitution, because they wanted to say they were the Constitutionalist Party. They were the ones who were upholding the law. But that whole performative thing fell apart once they realized they would have to get up and read the parts that talked about the slave trade being extended until, you know, for another 20 years, and about the, you know, fugitive escape law. So nobody wanted to be on the record standing in Congress reading these parts of the Constitution, so they didn't do it. So they're aware of, you know, that this is a, you know, a blemish document, and one that really needs to kind of be dealt with. You know, another issue that we're seeing, again, should be resolved and should have been resolved in the Constitution, is around redistricting. Right. This should not be, let's leave this up to the states, you know, states' rights, you know, in Article 10, you know, has given broad leeway for all kinds of corrupt and undemocratic practices, one of which is we just decided we can figure out a way to get some extra seats and we're going to do it. And the federal government has nothing to say about it unless they can squeak through, which may be working, actually, the fact that it violates the Voting Rights Act, and that the racial dimensions of redistricting cannot be covered up by what they're trying to do in Texas and probably some other places, North Carolina, for example. So they're reaching, you know, conflicts of interest around that. But this should not even be debated. We should not even be at this point. It should be clear, following the 10-year census, there is redistricting, and it doesn't happen for another 10 years unless there's some extraordinary circumstance. And there hasn't been, other than a demand from Donald Trump, who's fearful of being impeached for third, fourth, fifth, and sixth times.
Forgive my ignorance. If you can explain further what the non-census cycle of changing districts, what are the explanations that you hear again? What are the justifications, or are there not any?
So there doesn't have to be any, basically. So the Supreme Court ruled in a case, I can't remember the name of it, but that basically partisan gerrymandering is allowable at the states. And so what that has meant or being interpreted to mean is we can redistrict virtually every other day if we find that, you know, it's to our benefit. The problem actually that the Republicans are having is that they have gentrified. And so their ability to actually create more districts is very problematic because of where they're already at. But technically, what should be the case and what barely makes sense, what makes sense to, in terms of democracy, is that there should be a nonpartisan evaluation after each census. The census is taken every 10 years, and then make a determination, you know, what in that particular state is the fairest way to make sure that the people in all of their different demographics have a fair opportunity in not just the federal election, but also in state elections. Because when we look at like Texas or some of these places, there's state elections as well that are also going to be affected.
And dare I say, this is a question, not a statement. Some of the state constitutions seem to be a little bit more direct about this issue. Am I right or am I wrong about that?
You're right. So it varies. So there actually are a number of states that have nonpartisan redistricting commissions, and they have worked fine. But that doesn't exist at the federal level. There have been proposals in some of the electoral reform laws over the last 10 years. They just never made it out of Congress. The John Lewis Voting Rights Reform Act, I think it's called. You know, there have been others. They just have not went anywhere. But they have included issues like nonpartisan redistricting.
Let me do a bit of housework. And I know we only have about 4 or 5 more minutes to go. I want to remind listeners that indeed you are listening to WPFW 89.3 FM. We've been around for 48 years because listeners like yourselves choose to socially and financially support the station. I, along with 100 programmers and staff, and really do thank you from the bottom of our hearts. We appreciate the opportunity to be with you, to accompany you, all for the purpose of building better communities, a better world, one broadcast at a time. Examples of this would be at 3 p.m. to 5 on this day of broadcast, Sophie's Parlor, one of the oldest women collectives on public broadcasting, serving you by offering music and culture by women before everyone. Zen El Amin joins you at 2 p.m. On the Through the Air broadcast of this station with Shewanana that covers Middle Eastern affairs. And at 1 p.m., Africa Now with host Moise Mutale, produced by James Pope. Stories and narratives and accounts in history, politics, the environment, economy, culture of African descendant people, not only on the continent, but throughout the world, throughout the diaspora. All that and more, including every noontime hour of Don't Forget the Blues, the Wednesday edition, will come to you by way of Clarence the Blues Man Turner at noon. We do that noontime every weekday, all that and more. Dr. Lussain, thank you for being with us. Again, we're talking to Dr. Clarence Lussain about the U.S. Constitution. Is it anti-democratic? Does it fuel authoritarianism, particularly what we're experiencing now? You know, I'm going to do something unconventional with the 3 to 4 minutes we have. It's just freestyle. I know you've written about elements of the 14th Amendment. You might have other concerns to express. How do you want to close out your bringing attention to our interaction with the Constitution, sir?
So a couple of things. So one, the amendments to the Constitution have way disproportionately focused on voting and access and democracy. So of the 17 amendments that were passed after the first 10, after the Bill of Rights, about two-thirds of those have had to do with voting. It had to do with getting rid of the poll tax, giving women the right to vote, black men after the Civil War, restricting presidents to only being able to be elected to two terms, you know, all of that, because there had not been the kind of engagement of the country around a voting system, an election system that would be fair. And every other country on the planet has a system in which there's equality across the country in terms of how people engage in elections. Only the U.S. has states' rights, so that some states will have early voting, some states will not. Some states make it easy to do mail-in voting, some states do not. Some states will have, you know, people be able to vote just, you know, in very, very easy terms. Others make it difficult. That is a central reform that should be at the top of the agenda, because that's the door to creating the kind of policies and other activities that will allow folks to really begin to build a democratic country. In terms of the Constitution and amending it, the very first amendment that needs to happen is amending how you amend the Constitution. Because until that changes, it becomes nearly impossible.
Well, Dr. Lusain, I want to thank you for being with us in this hour. We still have to have community. We still have to have democracy. In many ways, I hope your observations serve as an encouragement to listeners to be concerned about this issue. My thanks to you, sir, and continue your work. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And thank again. Thanks to the listeners.
That will wrap it up for this particular episode of We the People. I thank you for staying with us in this hour. I thank the News and Public Affairs Station of WPFW, our staff. Our program director, Katia Stitt, was our engineer today, and I thank her as well. But most importantly, thank you, the listener, for supporting this station for over 48 years. It's no accident. You do want better communities, better worlds, and we thank you. Coming up throughout the day is news from the Public Affairs Department 5 minutes before the hour. And the next program you will hear is Don't Forget the Blues with Clarence the Bluesman Turner. Take care, and perhaps again we'll meet on the radio.
It's not the people. WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFW FM.
WPFW thanks all of the listeners who have supported us these 48 years. Now, with the attacks on independent media, we're asking listeners to step up again a few days before Giving Tuesday to give WPFW some dap on Cash App by putting $5 on supporting WPFW in advance of Giving Tuesday. Skipping one expensive drink this week in order to support your independent jazz and justice station would have a huge impact on ensuring the work we do continues. You can donate online at WPFWFM.org or on Cash App by entering $WPFWFM and putting $5 on supporting us. Thanks.
Mutual aid, the act of taking care of each other, comes in many forms. One such form is supporting WPFW. At a time when so many are hurting, if you are doing well financially and want to do good, we invite you to give the gift of WPFW. Emancipatory media is truly the gift that keeps on giving. A tax-deductible donation can be made anytime at WPFWFM.org or from Sunday, December 14th through Saturday, December 20th, during our pledge drive by calling 800-222-9739. It is your continued support that allows us to do the work of building a more equitable world, one broadcast at a time.
I am Jaren with Dreaming Out Loud.
And I'm Ron Motz with the Go-Go Museum and Cafe. This holiday season, Historic Anacostia is bringing joy from December the 11th through the 22nd.
A celebration filled with daily surprises along Marion Barry and MLK Jr. Avenue Southeast. Christmas tree lighting, live concerts at the Go-Go Museum, and holiday meals and deals from your favorite Anacostia businesses.
12 days of festive family fun as you dine, shop, and explore DC's Arts and Culture District. Powered by the Anacostia Bid, artsagogo.org. For more information.
Inviting all DC hand dancers, Philly boppers, Chicago steppers, Carolina shaggers, and West Coast swingers. The Treehouse Dreamers venue offers dance music from Motown and more every Friday, 1 to 5 p.m. at 4722 14th Street Northwest. DJ Jam and Dave and other fine DJs provide an atmosphere offering seniors socialization while getting much needed quality movement through familiar tunes and dance every Friday. Details at 301-922-4064. That's 301-922-4064. WPFW offering wellness through dance, one activity at a time.
And in just a few moments, we will have Clarence, Don't Forget the Blues, Turner. That's Clarence. So we appreciate you listening. We appreciate you listening, and he will be with you in just a second. Don't forget, you can still put five on it, as our dear brother Aize said, on the Cash App, $5. Everyone listening, if we do that, we will exceed the goal for Giving Tuesday. But if you can't use Cash App, you certainly can go to the website and make a pledge of support. WPFWFM.org. Clarence Turner is up next with Don't Forget the Blues. This is